Edition. From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Iraqis cast ballots despite threat of violence. Russia shows its modern military in Ukraine crisis. China's president ends visit to the troubled Xinjiang region, plus resistance to antibiotics spreading around the world. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Violence marred Election Day in Iraq on Wednesday, with at least two people killed as voters took part in parliamentary elections. Elizabeth Arrett has more in this report for VOA TV from our Middle East Bureau.
Iraqis Wednesday took part in their first parliamentary election since the 2011 withdrawal of U.S. troops. Security was on full alert across the country, suffering from a surge in sectarian and ethnic violence. In Kirkuk, struck by a deadly blast early Wednesday, voters hoped a new government could bring stability.
We asked the government to help build a free and democratic Iraq with no difference between the ethnic groups and sects, and we call upon them to form a new government as soon as possible to defeat terrorism.
9,000 candidates are vying for 328 seats, with current Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's party the frontrunner. Al-Maliki hopes to secure a third term and warned of consequences to those boycotting the vote.
Those who will take part in the election will have a right to monitor and ask questions, just as those who will not take part will have no right.
The voting was boycotted by Sunni insurgents, one of numerous anti-Maliki factions that accuse him of monopolizing power and deepening divides. If no party wins a majority, Maliki may find allies in parties, including those seeking to legalize the rape of women by their husbands and drop the minimum age of marriage for girls from 18 to 9. Analysts fear negotiations could be protracted as they were in 2010, when Iraq was without a new government for months. But some voters were hopeful this time the election will not only ease the nation's internal problems, but a larger geopolitical one.
We want to elect the government and the parliament which we want. We will elect by our own free will and not the will of the outside powers.
U.S. troops may be gone, but Washington continues to press for a united federal Iraq, while regional players make inroads. Iran's Shiite leaders back the current government, while Saudi Arabia favors Sunni elements, the same dynamic seen in Syria, whose civil war is increasingly enmeshed with Iraq's woes. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
You can keep up to date on the events in Iraq by going to our website, voanews.com. Also in the news, Ukraine's interim president Alexander Turchynov says his government is helpless in quelling a growing pro-Russian separatist movement in two eastern regions, and he says the situation has deteriorated to the point Kiev cannot control its own troops. Turchynov's admission came Wednesday at a meeting with regional governors in Kiev. He singled out mounting difficulties in Donetsk and Luhansk regions, where he said some military units are cooperating with terrorist organizations. Turchynov said his government will instead shift its focus to maintaining control of the nearby Kharkiv and Odessa regions. The mayor of Kharkiv, who has been credited with maintaining calm in Ukraine's second city, was shot in the back earlier this week while cycling as separatists tightened their grip on large parts of the east. Mr. Turchynov told regional governors that the threat of a Russian invasion is real and that Ukraine's military remains on full alert. An estimated 40,000 Russian troops are deployed on the Ukrainian border, poised to invade if the order comes from Moscow. VOA senior correspondent Andrei Dineshner looking now at the makeup of the Russian military.
Western estimates say the Russian Defense Ministry controls between 800,000 and 1 million men under arms. These include strategic rocket forces, as well as the various services, air, air defense, ground, and naval. And there are various kinds of special forces, such as the Spetsnaz, belonging to Russia's military intelligence, or GRU. Stephen Blank, an expert on the Russian military at the American Foreign Policy Council, says there are also paramilitary forces.
The other forces belong to other ministries. The Ministry of Interior, which are the internal forces of the MVD. The FSB has forces, that's the intelligence. There are border troops. And then there are paramilitaries like various Cossack formations. So there are lots of people involved here, probably something like a million men total in the regular armed forces, several hundred thousand more in these auxiliaries of the MVD, FSB, and Cossacks, and so on.
Ian Brzezinski from the Atlantic Council says the Russian government is spending a lot of money to modernize its armed forces.
$750 billion between now and end of the next decade to, you know, replenish their maritime fleet, to replenish their air forces, to bring in fifth-generation aircraft, even more sophisticated air and missile defense systems. They continue to robustly test and develop new ballistic missile capabilities, and they continue their modernization of their ground forces.
Brzezinski and others say Russia's effort to modernize its military was prompted by the poor showing in Moscow's 2008 five-day war with Georgia over two separatist regions.
You may recall the pictures of drunk soldiers straggling in the rear, trying to catch up to the frontline troops, and the fact that the Russians had a little bit of difficulty taking on the Georgians, which didn't put on that strong a defense, and they were able to kind of press forward simply pure mass rather than skill.
Experts say one reform was to make the Russian military more mobile, better geared for rapid response and for local conflicts, rather than with the massive Soviet-style army. Kerr Giles, head of the Conflict Studies Research Center, says during the Georgian War, coordination between the different armed service branches was a problem for the Russians.
They didn't, for example, have the right kind of embedded forward air controllers with their ground units in order to actually communicate with air power. So some of the air losses in the Georgia War were actually shot down by their own side, by the Russians.
Ian Brzezinski says the results of the reform were on display during Russia's annexation last month of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula.
You see the way they've been performing in Crimea, where you had 20 to 30,000 Russian troops fan across that peninsula. Pretty slick uniforms, well-maintained equipment, and real stunningly or impressive discipline and communications discipline. They're certainly far more capable than they were 6 years ago.
Stephen Blank from the American Foreign Policy Council puts it this way.
What the improvement is the use of these forces in a extraordinarily disciplined, bloodless, swift way in conjunction with information warfare against Ukraine, saturation of the Crimea and eastern Ukraine with Russian propaganda, and the deployment of highly trained, modernized, combined forces on the Western strategic direction to intimidate, divert, and immobilize NATO and the Ukrainian armed forces.
Blank says members of the Russian military leadership believe that the end of the Cold War was an American special operation to take down the Soviet Union without firing a shot, and it succeeded. Blank says the Russian military tried to do the same with success in Crimea. Andre Dineshner of VOA News, Washington.
Each week on Daybreak Asia, we cover the stories of women who are working to change the world.
She was locked up by her family when she reached puberty, which happens to all the Muslim girls in her village. And she then went on to become a politician and an activist. And she's an all-round amazing person, really.
I'm Frances Alonso, producer of Women Rising. Listen for my reports about the empowerment of women around the world on Daybreak Asia and on the web at voanews.com.
An explosion rocked a railway station in China's troubled far western region of Xinjiang, and the state broadcaster CCTV said three people were killed, 79 others were injured. The attack on Wednesday came as President Xi Jinping wrapped up a four-day visit to the area. It was unclear whether Mr. Xi was still in the region at the time of the blast, which occurred at the rail station in the regional capital of Urumqi. Ethnic tensions have been simmering for years in Xinjiang, the home of the Muslim Uyghur minority group. In 2009, a series of riots broke out in Urumqi, leaving nearly 200 people dead, according to official figures. Despite a heavy crackdown, violence has continued in the region and began spreading elsewhere in the country last year. Chinese state media report during his visit to the region, President Xi urged government officials to maintain social stability, promote growth, and improve living standards, as well as strengthening ethnic unity. James Leibold is a senior lecturer at Australia's La Trobe University and a Beijing-based ethnic minorities expert. He told VOA's Victor Beatty the Xi visit to Xinjiang was significant.
It's very rare for Chinese party leaders, top leaders, to venture off into the frontier. And usually when they do, they only make it as far as Urumqi or Lhasa. The fact that he went to Kashgar was meant to send, I think, a clear signal to both party officials inside the autonomous region as well as officials throughout China that Xi is going to be tough. Xi and his regime are going to be tough on splittist activities as well as any sort of terrorist activities emanating from Xinjiang as well as other parts of the Chinese frontier. Well, I think it comes against the backdrop of a perception of a rising spike in both inter-ethnic violence, particularly Uyghur on Han violence, that was, first escalated in 2009 in July 5th with a riot in Urumqi, but which has continued with seeing, according to state media, some 200, quote, terrorist incidences in Xinjiang in 2003. Of course, the seepage of this issue also outside of Urumqi as marked by the Tiananmen Square car bombing, as well as the Kunming train station attack in the 1st of March of this year. So this is the backdrop, and this is one of a range of efforts by Xi to signal that his regime is going to be tough on this type of terrorist-related activity, as well as anything that harms inter-ethnic relations or Chinese sovereignty.
James, he called the area the front line in terms of fighting terrorism and maintaining social stability. The situation, you said, is grim and complicated. China now faces, he said, the most complicated internal and external factors in history. How serious is the government viewing what's going on in Xinjiang?
Yeah, well, I think he said Xinjiang's at the forefront of counterterrorism efforts, and I believe that's the case, but I think it goes much further than that. I think Xi sees Xinjiang as absolutely crucial to a whole range of his policy initiatives. So as clearly identified by this visit, one of them at the forefront is counterterrorist efforts, as well as ethnic, the solution of the so-called ethnic issue through greater integration of the Uyghurs into Chinese society. But I think it goes beyond that, Victor. Xi Jinping chaired a meeting of the Politburo on the 19th of December of last year, during which he gave a speech that hasn't been made public, but as reported by Xinhua, he supposedly outlined a new grand strategy for Xinjiang. And I think this grand strategy goes beyond terrorist issues as well as ethnic issues. And he sees kind of a shifting west in China's orientation to the world. Obviously, Xinjiang is crucial for natural resources that flow in from Central Asia and Russia. He's also keen to open up new markets in Central Asia. He's talked about building a new Silk Road economic belt. And so the government sees Xinjiang not only crucial to the ethnic and terror issue, but as well as pushing his so-called deepening of economic reforms. And if you look at the reporting on the Kashgar trip, despite the photo ops with all the soldiers, it was stated that the aim of the trip was to further his economic reform agenda as laid out in the third plenum of the 18th Party Congress last October.
Leibold says during his stay, Mr. Xi visited a Uyghur family home and a bilingual school where he encouraged ethnic integration and the use of both Mandarin and Uyghur languages. Leibold believes this is mostly rhetoric and expects efforts to integrate Uyghurs in the Han-dominated society will continue. Malaysian Defense Minister Hishamuddin Hussein spoke with reporters on Wednesday about what comes next in the search for the missing Malaysia Airlines Flight 370.
I will be going, hopefully, to Australia to discuss the next phase. I think to be fair to the Australians and all our SAR partners, they have not talked about dollars and cents at all up to now. But looking forward, as we go into deep sea search, it is important that the issue of costs be discussed, and it will be discussed with all the stakeholders.
And then the reporters went on to question him about the next phase of the search and what it will cost.
We won't know what the cost would be until first we decide where we're going to search, secondly, what assets are going to be used to search, and who is going to supply those assets. And that is being done by the three committees that I have formed, which is the technical committee, the asset committee, and the family that's involving the next of kin.
An unmanned submarine is continuing to search underwater in an area where sounds consistent with the plane's black box were detected earlier this month. Additional equipment is expected to be brought in within the next few weeks to scour an expanded underwater area. Head of the Australian agency leading the search has predicted that the search could drag on for as long as a year. The Boeing 777 disappeared on March 8th on a flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing with 239 people aboard.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
U.S. State Department says al-Qaeda and its affiliates continue to present a serious threat to the United States and its allies. State Department's annual report on terrorism says losses in al-Qaeda's core leadership in Pakistan and Afghanistan have accelerated the network's decentralization. It says that has resulted in a more operationally autonomous and more aggressive affiliates, notably in Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Northwest Africa, and Somalia. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is beginning a visit to Africa for talks aimed at halting violence in South Sudan and the Central African Republic. The secretary's first stop in Addis Ababa, where he will meet with foreign ministers of Ethiopia, Uganda, and Kenya to discuss the South Sudan conflict. On Tuesday, a senior State Department official said Mr. Kerry will deliver tough messages to both the Sudanese government and its rebels. The United States has threatened travel and financial sanctions on those responsible for violence that has displaced more than a million people. Meantime, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has urged South Sudanese President Salva Kiir to call for an end to what Mr. Ban calls a negative campaign against UN peacekeepers and to bring justice to those responsible for attacks on civilians and UN staff. In a telephone call, the UN chief urged President Kiir to halt the vicious fighting and appalling killing of South Sudanese civilians. UN aid chief in South Sudan, Toby Lanzer, has called for a month-long truce, warning 7 million people face hunger if the four-month conflict continues. Two UN officials are holding talks with South Sudanese leaders in the conflict, human rights official Navi Pillay and Adama Deng, the UN Special Advisor on Prevention of Genocide, and met with Riek Machar, the former vice president who leads the rebel forces.
We had a good meeting of about 35 minutes and gave him the concerns of the Secretary General about protection of civilians. And we received assurances from him that he himself is investigating the human rights violations that occurred in Bientu, and that he is also concerned about protection of civilians here. He finds it difficult to be in the situation where he is. But I welcome the fact that he is clearly thinking in terms of a political solution.
The United Nations has accused rebels of hunting down hundreds of people in a hospital, church, and mosque in Bintou on April 15th and killing them based on their ethnicity and nationality. World Health Organization warns resistance to antibiotics is spreading to all regions around the world and is now a major threat to public health. A new WHO report analyzes data from 114 countries. It finds antibiotics are no longer effective in treating potentially life-threatening illnesses in a growing number of people. Lisa Schlein reporting now from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
This report is the first and most comprehensive look at antimicrobial resistance. It presents a frightening view of a world without effective antibiotics to treat common infections. The World Health Organization says this serious threat is not a prediction for the future. It is happening right now in every region of the world. The report focuses on antibiotic resistance in seven different bacteria, which are responsible for common serious diseases such as diarrhea, pneumonia, urinary tract infections, and gonorrhea. WHO's Assistant Director General for Health Security, Keiji Fukuda, says hospitals in all regions of the world are reporting untreatable or nearly untreatable infections.
If we take a look at an important infection like gonorrhea, this is an infection which affects about 1 million people per day, an important sexually transmitted disease. We now see that 10 countries have reported finding gonorrhea, which is untreatable by any antibiotic. So we have no medical treatment for this infection in many of these instances.
Among those countries are Austria, Canada, Japan, South Africa, Sweden, and the United Kingdom. Untreated gonorrhea can cause infertility, ectopic pregnancy, and blindness in babies born to infected mothers. The WHO report also notes that treatment of some urinary tract infections is now ineffective in more than half of patients. It says antibiotic resistance causes people to be sick for longer periods and increases the risk of death. Health officials cite the misuse and inappropriate use of drugs and the practice of adding antibiotics to agricultural feed to fatten animals as some of the factors leading to growing antibiotic resistance. Dr. Fukuda says the healthcare system relies on these medicines to protect people when they are most vulnerable.
It means that when people develop cancer and are on chemotherapy and become immunocompromised, they are at much higher risk for complications and infections and severe ones. When babies are born prematurely, they are in the same situation. When we have children who are malnourished, they are at much higher risk for infections.
He says similar devastating scenarios are playing out whenever people go in for surgery. Dr. Fukuda warns more people are likely to die from these infections. He notes resistance also increases the cost of health care, with lengthier stays in the hospital and more intensive care required. He says effective antibiotics have been one of the pillars allowing people to live longer, healthier lives. He warns everyone will suffer from antibiotic resistance, especially those in poor, developing countries. The World Health Organization is using this report to kickstart a global effort to address drug resistance. It says nations and people should view these findings as a wake-up call for a global plan of action to tackle this growing problem. It says efforts must be intensified to educate people and increase awareness of the looming dangers. And it says tools and medications must be developed to replace those that are becoming ineffective. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
British actor Bob Hoskins, whose very career ranged from an award-winning role in the film Mona Lisa to the semi-animated movie Who Framed Roger Rabbit, has died. He was 71. A versatile actor capable of playing menace, poignancy, also having that Cockney charm, Hoskins appeared in some of the most acclaimed British films of the past few decades, including the gangster classic The Long Good Friday. In 2012, Hoskins announced that he had been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease and was retiring from acting. He died from complications of pneumonia. Al Feldstein, whose 28 years at the helm of Mad Magazine transformed the satirical publication into a pop culture institution, has died. He was 88. Building on a character used by Mad founding editor Harvey Kurtzman, Feldstein turned the freckle-faced Alfred E. Newman, always seen on the cover of the magazine, into an underground hero, a dim-witted everyman of sorts and a gap-toothed smile with a recurring stock phrase, "Why me? Worry?" Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us. You know, you can always find us on the internet at voanews.com. Hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Kelvin Fowler, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Thursday.
This is Today in History. May 1st is often called May Day. Traditionally, May Day was celebrated by ancient Europeans as the time to make their first spring plantings. May Day later became an observance sparked by the labor movement to recognize the achievements of the working class. On this day in 1898, only days after war had been declared between Spain and the United States, U.S. Commodore George Dewey achieved a naval victory over the Spanish in the waters of Manila Bay in the Philippines. On this day in 1960, an American U-2 spy plane piloted by Francis Gary Powers was shot down over the Soviet Union. Powers was captured, tried, and sentenced to 10 years in prison. In 1962, he was exchanged for a captured Soviet spy. In 2011, U.S. President Barack Obama announced that terrorist leader Osama bin Laden, the mastermind of the September 11th attacks on the U.S., had been killed by United States Special Forces in Pakistan. On this day in 1786, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart's masterpiece, The Marriage of Figaro, premiered at Court Theater in Vienna. The Marriage of Figaro is today one of the most performed operas in the world. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States, along with its G7 partners, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the United Kingdom, and the EU, is deeply concerned over the continued efforts by separatists backed by Russia to destabilize eastern Ukraine. Ukraine has taken steps to meet its commitments under the April 17th Geneva Accord. These actions include working towards constitutional reform and decentralization, proposing an amnesty law for those who will peacefully leave the buildings they have seized in eastern Ukraine, and supporting the work of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. In addition, Ukraine has acted with restraint in dealing with the armed bands illegally occupying government buildings and forming illegal checkpoints. In contrast, Russia has taken no concrete actions in support of the Geneva Accord. It has not condemned the acts of pro-separatists seeking to destabilize Ukraine, nor called on armed militants to leave peacefully the government buildings they've occupied and put down their arms. Instead, Russia has continued to escalate tensions with ongoing threatening military maneuvers on Ukraine's border. The United States and its G7 partners strongly condemn Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea and Sevastopol. The G7 is now following through on consequences for this illegal annexation, including economic, trade, and financial areas. The United States announced it is imposing sanctions on 7 Russian government officials, including 2 members of President Vladimir Putin's inner circle, who will be subject to an asset freeze and a U.S. visa ban, and 17 companies linked to Putin's inner circle, which will be subject to an asset freeze. In addition, the Department of Commerce will deny or revoke some licenses granted to Russian companies seeking to export high-technology defense equipment. The international community has been unified in its position that Russia must cease its provocative actions in Ukraine. The United States remains prepared to impose still greater costs on Russia if the Russian leadership continues its provocative actions in Ukraine.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237 USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.